Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd.
And I'm Steve Junker. Happy President's Day.
Today, we're going to maybe learn some things about U.S. presidents that we did not know. Joining us in studio is Wendy and Ven Northcross. They have spent the last 20 years visiting presidential libraries, homes, grave sites, collecting memorabilia and interesting facts. Good morning.
Good morning.
And let me start off by saying that it's not the federal designation for today is not President's Day. It's actually Washington's birthday. Is that right?
That's correct. It was actually during the Nixon administration that they passed a law, a federal law, that all federal holidays would be on the same holiday Monday every year, so people could plan. And
so you could have a three-day weekend,
off.
Right?
Yeah. go to Cape Cod on vacation.
The only three holidays that were not affected were Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. Those kind of have to be on whatever day of the week they fall, but all the other holidays are designated on a Monday.
But the way they set this up, it will never actually fall on Washington's birthday, as I understand it, because Washington's birthday is the 22nd of February, and it has to be the third Monday in February, so it's always the 15th to the 21st.
Mathematically impossible.
I think they rolled Abraham Lincoln in, too.
Who's the 12th, but so correct. It's never actually going to be on his birthday
so
either.
So they split the difference.
There you go.
They did.
866-999-4626 is our number. We'd like to know, who is your favorite president? Or if you visited one of the presidential sites, what'd you think? Were you overwhelmed, underwhelmed? Tell us what your thoughts were. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Now, there isn't a presidential library for all of our presidents.
No, there are actually only – there have been 44 men who have been president of the United States. I know that President Trump is the 45th, but Grover Cleveland was actually the 22nd and 24th president. So there have only been 44 men who have been president. And of those 44, only 13 have presidential libraries. But it's all run by the National Archives. They just don't have the volume of things that FDR actually had the first presidential library. And he wanted it – he actually used it while he was still president.
Oh, interesting.
He, as a matter of fact, his library is where he did some of his famous fireside chats from. And it was after FDR established his library and turned all his papers and everything over to the government, then Herbert Hoover, who had been president before FDR and who lived until 1964, he established a library after the fact.
And in these libraries, we find all the, you know, like scholarly work, right?
Absolutely. There's millions of documents, literally, for each of the presidents in the libraries. And the more recent presidents, thousands and thousands of hours of videotape and audio tape. And it's a place for serious scholarship. People that are writing books and things like that will go to the libraries, and it's all cataloged very carefully by the National Archives, and they can have access to it. Most of the libraries we've been to, of course, we're not doing scholarship work.
I was going to say, you're not doing scholarly work, right?
But they have museums associated with them, and they are very, very well done. And they have artifacts in the museums that – I mean, anyone would be interested, but in the George H.W. Bush Library, the 41st president, his library is on the campus of Texas A&M, and they have the presidential limo in there that that he actually used while he was there. The Reagan Museum, which we have not visited in California, has Air Force One in the...
Now, is that on your list? Is that one of the places you'd like? Oh, yeah, we're both nodding. So, Wendy, what started this fascination with presidential, everything presidential?
Well, believe it or not, when we created the JFK Hyannis Museum, sort of out of self-defense, because everyone wanted to go to the compound and have tea with Rose, we got very interested in how other places interpret their presidents. You know, it was more about a, because we weren't a presidential library and we weren't a presidential historic site per se. It's like, how do you tell that story? So just happened to, you know, you're fortunate in New England because there's so many places nearby. But as we were traveling, we would just sort of add on to our travels a nearby presidential site until one day we said, you know, we got a critical mass here. We need to like start checking off the list and making notes.
Well, it was interesting to learn how other communities that have presidents, how they interpret their president.
And you keep these amazing, like it's better than a scrapbook. It's kind of like a scrapbook, but you have these huge binders that you have all this stuff that you've collected.
Well, yeah, we collect pictures, and a lot of the places, particularly the family homesteads and things like that, they don't allow you to take pictures inside, but they sell postcards in the gift shop. So we'll take photos and buy the postcards and mix them together, and sometimes it's I have to pull them out and look at the back, say, did I take this picture, or is this a postcard, you know? But
we like to support the gift shops, too.
Of course, yeah.
Of course.
It's important.
So when you're choosing, so it started out, you would choose presidential sites based on where your vacation was already happening.
Right.
And has it changed? I mean, it's been like 20 years you've been doing this. So now do you actually purposely go to an area to see a presidential site?
Well, let's say we decided once to drive to, I had a meeting in Minnesota. I said, let's drive there. So we can catch some Ohio presidents on the way.
There's eight of them in Ohio.
Yeah. Wow. Ohio. We like have to now plan.
You have to plan an extra 2 months.
Eight sites in Ohio. I said, we got to go there for a year sometime.
So who's, do you have a favorite president? I know I asked you that, Van, and you don't. There's just too many that you're interested in.
Well, there are definitely some presidents that are more popular than others. In the Constitution Center in Philadelphia, where they have the Liberty Bell, and they have some wonderful exhibits. And one of the things you can do is they have a voting booth, and you can go into the voting booth and vote for your favorite president. And I did it. I voted for Teddy Roosevelt.
Now, why?
For some reason. I don't know. You know, he was flamboyant. He was a trust buster. He was high energy. We actually visited his home in Sagamore Hill on Long Island. And
we had
Oyster
to plan
Bay
that. Mm-hmm. And Not easy to get to.
It was one of the better hits we ever had. But there's a famous picture of him standing on his front porch with the press all out in the front yard. And he's pounding his fist and holding forth like he would do. So I had Wendy take my picture in the, on that same porch, pounding my fist like that. You know,
wasn't the same.
He didn't win, though. The day we were there, Thomas Jefferson was actually winning.
I thought JFK ranked really high.
JFK ranked very high.
So what about these presidents like William Henry Harrison and John Tyler? You've been there?
Well, William Henry Harrison was only president for a month. I mean, he died a month after he was inaugurated. And actually, that's...
Was he the one who caught a cold after his inauguration speech?
He gave the longest inaugural address ever, and he did it without a coat on and freezing temperatures. And he was kind of an old guy to begin with. But his vice president, it leads us into a whole other, any one of these things is going to lead us down a rabbit hole. But his vice president, John Tyler, who became president, the Constitution was very unclear about presidential succession. And a lot of members of Congress said, well, Tyler is now the acting president. And he was having none of it. He said, no, I am president. And he demanded that the oath of office be administered to him. He moved into the White House. He said, I am now the president. And but it was unclear whether he was really the president or the acting president.
Well, he was a very unpopular figure, too, Tyler.
He was. He absolutely was.
But then they cleared it up?
After the Kennedy assassination, there was I think it was actually after FDR died. They had a Presidential Succession Act, and we all remember when Reagan was shot and Alexander Haig, who was Secretary of State, showing up saying, I'm in charge here. Actually, he was not.
Yeah.
But
he wanted to be.
A lot of people were confused about, you know, what was going on. And it's still a little unclear. There's a great book about that I read recently. It's called The Accidental President, the eight men that became president when the sitting president either died in office or
what's unclear when you say that? What's unclear?
Well, it goes from the president to the vice president to the Speaker of the House to the Secretary of State. But after that, it's very unclear what would happen still, I mean, even to this day. But a lot of people don't realize that after the vice president, it's the – and that's just been recent amendments to the Constitution that have cleared that up. But there's a lot of things that can happen with the Speaker of the House, too, that there's no contingency plan for. So,
Wendy, do you have a favorite president?
Other than JFK?
I was going to ask if it was JFK.
Well, you know, I really got fascinated with Jimmy Carter because I actually met him and Rosalynn. I recently went to the JFK Library and the ranch in the hill country of Texas, and I just got to
the LBJ.
I mean, I said LBJ. Yeah. I'm sorry. Early in the morning still. LBJ has kind of found a new fascination for me. I want to learn more about him. I'm really fascinated with his wife. Mm-hmm. She was
a Lady Bird.
Mm-hmm. She was pretty much, she had a very strong personality. She ran businesses. She ran his congressional office when he went to war.
She owned a whole bunch of radio stations.
She owned radio stations. Yeah. She was very well educated. So it's a fascinating, you know, you get exposed to these people in new ways. And it's like, oh, I want to learn more about that. So I think right now LBJ is right up there.
This fascinates. I read a book and I can't remember the name of it now, but I was reading this and, you know, he was a very persuasive man. And he was a large man and could be very intimidating. Mm-hmm. But you look at all that he accomplished in his presidency.
Amazing.
And we couldn't get not one of those bills through now.
It was the list on the wall. I mean, they literally had, and one of the reasons we go to these sites is to get ideas for here on the Cape. But there was the list on the wall of the legislation, and it was like 8 feet high, small print, two columns.
Wow.
From ceiling to floor, and I was just, you know, stunned.
Yeah. One of the interesting things that you shared that picture, Van, of there's like a picture of Elby. You can have your picture taken with this. Is it a hologram thing or is it a statue? What is
no,
that?
No, it's a photograph.
It's a photograph.
A life-size photograph, though, right? So you can see
intimidating somebody, leaning over somebody with a finger out, and you're like, yes, sir, yes, sir.
Yeah. You know, one of the best presidential authors that I've ever read, and I've got this goal to read at least one book about every president, but Doris Kearns Goodwin, I would read anything
she's amazing. Yeah.
She actually worked for Lyndon Johnson in the Johnson White House back in the days when she was Doris Kearns. Mm-hmm. That was before she married Dick Goodwin, who was a speechwriter for JFK. But she wrote a book. When Johnson left office, she was one of the aides that he took with him to Texas. He wanted her to write his autobiography, and she wrote a very, very excellent book called The American Dream, and it's about Johnson and all his legislation.
Right. And I don't think that was the book I read, but I don't remember. There is another one. It's a male author.
No Ordinary Time about...
That could be. I don't remember the name of it.
The Kennedys and the Fitzgeralds.
So what did you think of... how does the LBJ experience compare to some of the other presidents? Because, you couldn't go in his house. You said...
We could walk around the ranch. It's huge. His boyhood home is there. The school that he taught school in. He was a school teacher, which was one of his interests, of course, was in education and Head Start, I think, was one of the programs during his administration.
The one-room schoolhouse that he went to school in when he was a boy is on the grounds there. And one of the massive pieces of legislation he passed was an education bill. And he had the signing of that bill on the lawn of that schoolhouse, and he brought the teacher who taught him as a boy back to sit by his side as he signed that bill into law.
He knew how to stage a political moment.
Harry Truman, when we were at the Truman Library in Independence, Missouri, we learned that LBJ, when he got Medicare through the Congress, he went to the Truman Library in Independence, Missouri, and had Harry Truman sitting next to him when he signed that bill into law. Yeah. Something that Truman had worked very hard to do.
He had absolute love for Texas and its wide open spaces, and he would go back as often as he could. And I remember thinking, you know, I didn't really know that much about President Johnson, but when I walked that ranch and you could just smell the fragrant air, and it was summertime, it was hot, but it was just beautifully shaded and wonderfully It just there was just a vibe there that you just said, "Oh, I get it." Mm-hmm. This was, you know, what the ocean was to JFK, these huge acres and beautiful, you know, landscape was to LBJ. They just restored both of them.
Mm. Do you feel like that's part of the when you go to visit a presidential birthplace or home site, is this you're taking away a little piece of what their experience was in life and how that might have helped create their character and made those decisions that
absolutely
influenced so much?
Absolutely. And I'll give you a quick example of that. The Martin Van Buren's home in Kinderhook, New York, which is right up the river from Hyde Park where FDR's home was. It's his home. The best homes are the ones that no one else has ever lived in, just the president and the president's family.
Up, right?
Exactly. But Lindenwald was the name of his home there in Kinderhook, New York. And you're in that home. We had the most wonderful experience in there. The day we were there, it's run by the National Park Service. We were the only ones there. We had like a private tour. And there was a table, this massive, beautiful dining table that was original to the home.
Literally about 20 feet long. Mm.
It must have sat 40 or 50 people easily at dinner. But it had been sold off somewhere and bought by a very wealthy family who was building the house that it was going to go into. And the table had been restored. And until they were ready to put it in their new house, they had put it back in Van Buren's home. And it just so happened that it was one of those serendipitous things that happens to us all the time. We saw that table in its original
in situ
spot for that little small window of time that it was going to be there. Yeah. But
you're listening to The Point. We are talking all things presidents this morning, learning about U.S. presidents' sites. Van and Wendy Northcross have spent the last 20 years visiting presidential libraries, homes, grave sites, and collecting all kinds of memorabilia and interesting facts. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, George Washington is my favorite.
I was going to say.
Yeah, but you know, the more you read about him and the more you learn about him, he really was an amazing man.
And an amazing time, an inflection point in our history. It's like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Right?
And everything he did was precedent setting.
Right.
Yeah.
Every move he made was precedent setting.
And he had a sense of that. I think, and that's why he was so careful about how he carried out the presidency.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Only one that was unanimously elected.
Yeah. We almost had another one. We almost had another unanimous. That would be our fifth president, James Monroe.
Oh.
In his second term, it was what they called the era of good feeling. And he would have been unanimously elected by the electors, except for one elector who said, no one but George Washington should have that distinction. And he voted against Monroe.
Oh, that's funny.
Just to keep him from having it.
Let's talk to Peter, who's giving us a call from Provincetown. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Mindy. How are you?
Good.
I had the opportunity to go up to Campobello. I must recommend it to all your listeners. If you have a chance, take a drive up the coast of Maine and go into that little corner of Canada that you reach by going over the bridge at Lubeck. Mm-hmm. And what the Canadians have done there in a typical, spectacular Canadian National Park fashion is that they've set up a whole complex of parks. They have acquired all of the homes, not just FDR's Campobello, but all of the homes looking out toward Eastport. And I want to say that the house itself is really just a beautiful house. It's very much like some of the summer cottages you see in places like Seal Harbor and that area of Maine. It has its own characteristic. The waterfront, just the view across the lawn toward Eastport.
It is beautiful.
Yeah. Peter, was it what you did? You have high expectations when you visited, or did you just visit kind of saying, you know, what, not knowing what you were going to see?
Not high expectations, but, you know, the whole idea of just going over this little bridge into Canada and then, you know, suddenly discovering that there was so much to see. The cluster of summer homes, the summer cottages, the various parks, as I said. I really give Canada, you know,
I would agree. Wendy and I visited there years ago, and it is the only national park in the world that is jointly run by two nations.
Oh,
it's run by Canada and the United States.
Yeah.
And it's also the place where FDR contracted polio.
Mm. Yeah, Peter. Thanks for calling. Thanks for mentioning that. Well, that's a road trip you could do with your grandkids, right?
Mm-hmm.
That
mm-hmm.
would teach them a little presidential history.
Well, you think about somebody like FDR. There's more than one site you have to go visit. Then
that's right.
Well, he's like Lincoln. He's kind of all over the place.
I was actually taken to Warm Springs, Georgia, mm-hmm. where he died, and saw the actual bed that he died in. But what was interesting about that, because the Roosevelts were fantastically wealthy, you know, comparatively, but their other places were very modest, very, you know, like cabin in the woodish kind of thing. So it isn't. Hyde Park is beautiful in my family lore. My my great grandfather who died in the influenza epidemic in 1918, he was an architect working for the DuPont family and the Roosevelt family, and he had done some work on the Hyde Park house, which is one of the reasons I had said to Van, we got to go to see that house. It was a magnificent house on Hyde Park, but these other places that they would, you know, recreate in were very modest.
Mm. Okay. Van, tell the story. We just mentioned Abraham Lincoln, and this, you had a really interesting visit to a place that President Lincoln spent a lot of time, and you could really just feel his presence.
Well, we had never even heard of it. They call it the Sanctuary, Lincoln Sanctuary, and it's actually on a military base right outside of Washington, D.C. Well, it was outside Washington, D.C. in Lincoln's time. If you go there now, you can't tell you're out of the city. It's just all one thing. But it was a place on a military base, and during the Civil War, there was a hospital set up there, so there were always a lot of wounded soldiers all around the area, and Lincoln used to wander around there quite a bit and talk with soldiers and things like that. But he disliked the White House very much. He disliked being there, and he would spend, like, from April through October, he would spend almost every night at the sanctuary, and he would treat the White House like an office, and he would go there during the day, and then he would ride, usually alone, at night. He would get on his horse and ride a couple of miles over to the sanctuary. This is while a war was going on.
Yeah.
If you can imagine that. There was no Secret Service. There was no military escort or anything like that. And as a matter of fact, one night someone took a shot at him and blew his hat off, that big stovepipe hat that he wore. But Wendy and I visited the sanctuary, and again, in one of those serendipitous things, you can't just show up there. You have to make a reservation and buy your tickets online ahead of time, which we had done. And we showed up at the appointed time on the day we were supposed to be there, and we were supposed to be with a bus tour that had not shown up. So we got almost a private tour of this house.
Which they tend to take you in different... show you some little extra special stuff, you know.
When you're, when there's just a couple. Yeah.
They must be so pleased because they're so steeped in this knowledge, and to have just a couple of people that can show you all the corners that they can't show a big group.
It's the sort of thing that happens to us a lot. Yeah. But the thing that I was sharing with Mindy is they had never really refinished any of the woodwork or anything in the house. It was all original. And there was a stairway going to the upstairs bedrooms that we walked up. And as you put your hand on that wooden handrail, you realize that this is the same handrail that Abraham Lincoln had his hand on every night going to bed. You know, it just gave you a feeling. That and the fact that by the front door there was like a peg rack, and they had one of his hats hanging on the peg rack, the stovepipe hat. And I asked the docent there, I said, "Can I put that on?" And he kind of laughed, and he said, "Sure." And I took the hat and put it on my head, and my head disappeared inside the hat. It was enormous.
Yeah. It was really one of his hats.
You know, he said it was. Now, whether or not it really was,
he probably had more than one hat.
He had a lot of hats.
He used to keep his papers in his hat.
I heard that.
He would ride on horseback. He would keeps yeah, papers.
But I just remember thinking, if this really is Lincoln's hat, he had a
big head. Yeah. So you learn all these things like you didn't know that existed. And I would think when you show up at these places and you're just, you know, the two of you or a couple more people, and your level of interest, I'm sure the docents just light right up and tell you all kinds of things that probably aren't on everybody else's tour, right?
So we went to Aurora, New York last winter.
About 30 miles below Buffalo.
Whose house was that?
Whose house?
Millard Fillmore,
right? You talk about the presidents, you have to remember. You can't remember. And it was he was an attorney, and it was a very modest house, and it was the 1800s. I mean, they still were cooking in the fireplace kind of thing. And we had called ahead to try to get tickets to see or to make sure it was open. And he said, oh, we're sorry. The house isn't going to be open that time of the year. We're getting ready for a big Christmas event. And we're like, oh, we were disappointed. But we decided just to go anyway to Aurora and drive by and take pictures of the front. Well, we get there. It's an open house. The house is entirely decorated. They're having a little fundraiser Christmas bazaar fair there. And we're like, oh, yeah, we're in the house. We're buying stuff, which I always feel good about. And then they realized that we were the ones that called and they said, no, you can't tour it. So they took us upstairs where they never take anybody.
They had shoved a lot of the things up there.
To make room for the fair, the Christmas bazaar.
And they had like beds and things like that that were written on them
that had been
to the White House.
To the White House and back, So that was, they were like spending extra time.
So if you're going to Millard B. Fillmore's house, how much research do you do before you go? Do you have a sense of who this is? And do you have questions you want to sort of satisfy? Or do you just go there cold and say, tell me about this guy?
Well, he's one of the presidents I've read a book about. So I had a little bit of knowledge about him. His family was a farming family, and he just decided he didn't want to be a farmer, and he became a lawyer.
Right.
And he moved to Buffalo, and he was really one of the driving forces to build the Erie Canal, which opened Lake Erie up to the Hudson River, which opened it up to Atlantic trade. It's really what put Buffalo on the map. He was a New York State Assemblyman early in his career and things like that. But he was very important to that area of Western New York. And he was put on the ticket with Zachary Taylor when Zachary Taylor became president to sort of balance the ticket. Zachary Taylor was from Mississippi. He was an interesting guy. He never voted in an election. Zachary Taylor never voted, including in his own election. But they just put Millard Fillmore on the ticket to balance it so the Whigs could win the White House with Zachary Taylor, never imagining that he would die 2 years into his term and Fillmore would become president.
So much of American history is tied up in all of this. So as you're learning about the presence, like when you talk about the Erie Canals and the impact that they have, you're really getting a bigger sense of the whole picture of the country as you're putting these, adding each president into your binder and your visiting list.
Each had a massive contribution most people, you really need the perspective of about 30 or 40 years at least to understand what a president really meant to the country.
You mentioned James Polk already, and he was the most successful president in American history. During the 1844 campaign, he made 5 promises: to acquire California from Mexico, to settle the Oregon dispute, to lower the tariff, to establish a sub-treasury, and to retire from office after 4 years. When he left,
he did it.
He had done all of that.
Check.
And he's got a great house in Columbia.
He does,
Tennessee.
In Columbia, Tennessee. We've
highly
been
recommend
there.
It.
Yeah. We've been there.
Have you visited any of these sites that you were disappointed? Or is something? Have you always found something that's made the trip worthwhile?
Well, I don't know, Wendy. I've never
Chester
been
Arthur.
Disappointed in anything.
Chester
there,
Arthur.
There's some of them that Chester there's just... Arthur. There's some of them there's nothing to see.
Yeah.
I mean, like Zachary Taylor is an example. There's nothing to see.
You can drive by
his house in Kentucky. It's one of the houses where he lived. There's an historical marker out front, but it's a private residence.
Yeah.
You know, you can't go in there. Same with John Tyler down in the
Tidewater.
Down in the one of the Tidewater plantations. It's a private residence. You can't go in there. Chester Arthur, I'm glad you mentioned that, Wendy. He's an interesting one. He became president when Garfield was assassinated. He was one of those New York corrupt politicians that actually turned out to be a pretty good president. He was a good reform president because he knew how the corruption worked and he knew how to fix it. But he was probably the only president we ever had that was not eligible to be president, because one of the only requirements you have is that you're born in the United States. That's why Alexander Hamilton was never one of our early presidents. He wasn't eligible. He was born in Jamaica. But they're pretty sure that Chester A. Arthur was probably born in Canada.
But he claims Vermont.
You go up, you go way in northern Vermont to Fairfield, Vermont, and they've got this little, it's new construction. You can tell it was built with Home Depot lumber, you know, but it's a little house, and they say it's a replica of the house where Chester A. Arthur was born, maybe. But they admit that maybe he wasn't.
That's funny.
You have to go a long way to get there.
Yeah.
You mentioned Alexander Hamilton, and it's interesting because we had the musical Hamilton, which I think just about everybody's seen it maybe now. But
it's awesome.
It's awesome, but it was funny. We went with my brother-in-law and his wife to New York, and my brother-in-law was like, "You have to read the book first. He wanted us to read the book, which of course was a great read. But I was really amazed at how much history they were able to pack into that show. And I think it was that hip hop genre. Where else could you get that much information with it
that way?
And just the choreography, everything was just
fabulous.
But it really makes you appreciate Alexander Hamilton. And I think he would have been a great president.
You know, you can say that about, Dr. Joseph Warren, who was killed at Bunker Hill, there is no question he would have been one of our early presidents. Great patriot, brilliant individual, deep thinker. He absolutely would have been one of our early presidents had he not been killed at Bunker Hill. But any one of these guys that you read about, Mindy, I couldn't agree with you more. That you learn things about them and you're just in awe of how much they contributed to this country.
And how interesting history can be.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
With us in the studio as we talk presidents on this President's Day are Wendy and Van Northcross, who have spent the last 20 years visiting presidential libraries, homes, and grave sites and collecting interesting facts. I'm just amazed that, Van, you're sitting here with no notes. You're just sort of unrolling all this information at us. It's great.
I have notes in front of me.
You're listening to The Point. I'm Steve Junker with Mindy Todd. It's President's Day, and we are talking presidents with Van and Wendy Northcross, who have spent the last 20 years or so visiting presidential libraries, homes, grave sites, collecting information. And we are looking for your call right now, 866-999-4626. Join the conversation. Tell us about a presidential site you went to, or if you're ever had a close encounter with the president, give us a call, 866-999-4626. And Mindy, we have an email.
We have an email. Bob says, reverential experience. Can't believe the show is more than half over and Monticello hasn't been mentioned.
Aha.
You've been there.
We've been there.
It's a highly visited site.
Yeah.
And
yes,
it is beautiful. And you do learn a lot. You learn about the slavery story that they're embellishing that more. And the gardening. Oh, my gosh, the gardens are gorgeous. But what really surprised me about Jefferson is he replicated Monticello with a smaller version of it further out in Virginia called Poplar Forest that's been undergoing a renovation. And you have to drive down this, you know, winding dirt road to kind of get there. And it's beautiful. It's just, again, that sense of place. I mean, he was looking for a refuge, probably was getting pretty highly trafficked at Monticello with people coming and going and wanting to learn things. But he went and found himself another beautiful place that was also beautifully designed and constructed out in the woods.
So when you say he replicated it, he just made himself kind of a refuge. How much is it like Monticello, or is it
similarly in design?
Well, smaller scale, but
yeah,
similar.
You know, kind of that octagon thing with a lot of windows, beautiful beams. It had been pretty degraded, and so we saw it still in a little bit of a raw form. It's pretty.
You know, interesting thing about Monticello, they've got everything priced so that your change would be $2. And so, of course, Jefferson's face is on the $2 bill. So they had stacks of $2 bills that they're giving people their change with.
Do you have lots of surprises when you visit? I mean, you talk about these kind of serendipitous moments that you get. Do you learn things that you had no clue about with these visits?
Well, constantly.
Always, yeah.
But one of the things we learned, John, you know, one of the best sites we've ever visited is right up the road here in Quincy, the Adams family site.
I've never been there. It's so nearby.
Oh, it's
one of the best we've been to. But the day we decided, I mean, you see the brown signs that say historic site, and you go, it's in the middle of Quincy, why would you? You know, but we did one day. We just pulled in, and serendipitously, it was John Adams' birthday.
Hmm.
And everything was free, and they were having at the First Parish Church up in town, they were having a service to honor his birthday. And that was the first time we learned that every president on his birthday, the sitting president sends a wreath to the gravesite.
Hmm.
And so this was the day that the sitting president had sent the wreath to, and both John Adams and his wife Abigail and John Quincy Adams and his wife are the only two buried in the crypt of that church. And it's the only day of the year that they open the crypt.
In the basement.
And they go and place the wreath.
So
and
there we
Wendy
go down
and I
into
participated
the crypt.
In that ceremony.
And I'm standing in between John Adams and Abigail Adams. Literally,
wow.
Could put hands on both sarcophagus, and you just start shaking, you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
We had no idea that was
I didn't know they were buried in the basement of the church.
I think we have to start following them around on vacation.
I know. If you guys have an Instagram feed, yeah. I'll be following you.
It almost seems like it's just meant to be or something. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We talked a little bit about LBJ you visited last summer, but you also visited George H.W. Bush's.
Bush One.
Yeah.
And that was fascinating. And I loved it. And I didn't realize how parallel his life was to President Kennedy's life. I mean, educationally... you know, they're both from New England.
Military service.
Their family. Their family is hugely important. I mean, I really got a new appreciation and kind of a kinship, I felt, with Bush One, which now makes me really want to go to Bush Two. And I have a conference to go to Dallas this summer. And I said to Van, all right, you got to come with me. And we're going to grab that one.
Yep, I'm going.
Yeah. That's all she had to say is presidential site. Yeah, I'm there, right? So what did you think about President Bush One's site? Did you learn anything there?
Well, the museum was fascinating. Several things about it that were incredible. During World War II, he was a pilot. He was a fighter pilot. And the type of plane that he flew, they actually had one in the museum suspended from the ceiling that you could take a look at. In a lot of the museums, they have replicas of it. Like in the Clinton Museum, they replicated the cabinet room. And the George H.W. Bush Museum, they replicated the Oval Office as it was when he was there. But they also replicated his office at Camp David. And I had never seen anything about Camp David before. One thing I just learned from reading a book about Hoover was that Hoover, before Camp David, had a similar type camp in Virginia that was a fishing camp that's run by the National Park Service, and you can go there. I had never even heard of it.
Yeah, all these little things.
Are you adding that to your list?
Absolutely. It's on the list.
Can you visit Camp David?
No.
The people can't? No.
No.
Okay.
That's a
but you can visit the fishing hole, right?
The fishing, Hoover's camp we can visit, so we'll go there.
Megan has given us a call from West Harwich. Good morning, Megan.
Good morning. So what about Calvin Coolidge? I live on the Cape, but I grew up in Northampton, and he has a lot of presence there.
Yeah.
Been there.
Plymouth cool. Notch, one of the best.
That's great.
One of the best sites.
It's several buildings. Actually, it's almost the village is kind of given over to the Coolidge history. Yeah.
Yep, and his burial site is there as well.
I don't know where he was born, though. He wasn't born there, but he lived there. So do you know where he was born? Was he born in Vermont somewhere?
I think it was Vermont, wasn't it?
I think he was born in Vermont, but I know he lived a lot of his adult life in Massachusetts. He was actually a governor of Massachusetts.
Right. Is that how he became president? Was through being governor? Was that the next step?
Well, he actually became president by being vice president. And when Warren G. Harding died in office, that's when Coolidge became president. And it was one of the really cool things about his house in Plymouth Notch there. You go, you can stand in the very room where his father administered the oath of office to him at 3 o'clock in the morning.
So the internet tells me that Coolidge was born in the rear of the general store in Plymouth Notch.
Yes. Yeah, and it's there. It's still there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's still right there. It's one of the better presidential sites that we've ever been to.
Right. Megan, thanks.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Dan wants to know if you know anything about Gray Gables in Grover, Cleveland, right down the road.
We were cruising around
there yesterday.
Yeah. Actually, we did. There's a road called President's Road. And, well...
He's another one. Grover Cleveland was actually from New Jersey, but there's just nothing to see. The house that he had here in Bourne burned down years ago, but he was another fisherman. He liked to come here and he liked to fish. Little known fact about Grover Cleveland is that he had a very serious throat issue, and he had to have a very serious operation on his throat. And they kept that from the public. They brought a ship up into the harbor here.
Into the canal.
Into the canal harbor. And he went on board that Navy ship, and that's where they actually had the operation on his throat while he was president.
But they built a little train station for him to offload that's now part of the Uptoxic Trading Post Museum Complex, and that was further down the road. But, yeah, I mean, he loved Cape Cod. Yeah.
We have a lighthouse out in Buzzards Bay, Cleveland Ledge Light, that I've always been told is
probably
named
is.
After him because he was a fisherman, and it was kind of off Gray Gables. Yeah.
I'd be interested to know if the caller has information.
That was Dan who was asking the question.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
But we do have a call. John is calling from Orleans. Hi, John.
Hello. I believe it's Calvin Coolidge's summer White House is on Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. It's a huge house. I've seen it from the water. But that's my only contribution. Ever been there?
Never.
No.
Add that one to the list.
We're going to put it on the list, John. Thanks.
Interesting.
All right. So how long is this? Thanks for the call, John. How long is this list of where you haven't been that you want to go?
Oh, well, I have it here.
You really do.
We've been to 32 presidential sites, either libraries or birthplaces or homes or grave sites. Grave sites are interesting. Some of them are very simple and some of them are really elaborate. But
we have 9 presidents we need to go and bag.
That we have nothing on.
So Obama, Reagan, Ford, Hoover, Harding, Taft, Bush 43, or Bush 2, as I call him, McKinley, which I have a note here, says office only, and then Cleveland.
When we made that Ohio trip, there's an office that was a law office that was McKinley's that we actually went into that. It wasn't all that interesting, but it was pretty cool.
I have a little note here. James Madison, he was the smallest of all the presidents. Mm-hmm. He was only 5'4" and weighed less than 100 pounds.
Mm-hmm. And he looked great in suits.
He was supposed to be kind of a dandy, actually. I think
he was. Yeah. Yeah.
And then the tallest president, was that Lincoln?
It's got to be Lincoln.
Yeah, I would think.
Maybe LBJ would.
Oh, LBJ, yeah.
You should check that out.
All right.
So of the libraries, have you visited all 13?
No, we have 5 to go.
5 to go. Okay, so of the ones you've been, are they similar or are some more impressive than others?
I was also wondering if they reflect the character of the presidents, like if you go to a library.
Yeah, these are the fans, right, that are putting this.
I think they're all over the place.
Yeah, yeah they are. They really
and
are.
I think that, because they're more modern and I think they tend to be more academic. It's not as much of a sense of place, but they do have a really important role in translating their president. We have found that they are pretty strictly controlled by the archives. I mean, the National Archives sort of has a formula, and they don't deviate from the formula too much. But it is, again, it's for scholarly work. But you can also be entertained by seeing their museum pieces. But it's pretty impressive. The work that they have to do to protect and maintain that information is not simple. And I've always been, And we went to the LBJ's library, and it looked like a mausoleum inside. That's actually where he laid in state, I believe, after he died. But just three or four stories of glassed-in walls with paper, paper files, you know, beautifully preserved, but...
I'm interested about the, you mentioned the grave sites and how different they are. What are some of the presidential grave sites you found, and are they kind of, are they always marked, or I know they're always marked, but are they always like destinations, or are there some that are just quietly sitting there?
Well, they're, again, that's all over the place. Teddy Roosevelt's grave site there in Oyster Bay, New York, is very simple, and it's not all that well kept. You go there and... It's just not very well kept at all. Andrew Johnson, who was the first president to ever be impeached, you go to his gravesite in eastern Tennessee there in Johnson City, Tennessee, and it's this massive pillar with this huge golden eagle on top of it. And you would think Napoleon was buried there or something, you know. And Andrew Johnson unquestionably was one of our lesser presidents. But there have only ever been two presidents that buried in Arlington National Cemetery, which I think might surprise some people.
That surprised me.
Well, one of them, of course, we most of us saw JFK laid to rest on television. He's certainly one of them. But can you guess the other? Who's the only other president besides JFK?
Who was it?
It's William Howard Taft,
who
was Teddy Roosevelt's vice president. He has a... very near the front gate, actually, a very nice site. But he's the only other president buried there. There's one president buried in the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. The National Cathedral, which is the equal of any of the great European cathedrals, took 100 years to build. Teddy Roosevelt laid the cornerstone, and it's only recently been completed, has 75 gargoyles, one of which is Darth Vader.
Oh, no.
It has a moon rock in one of the windows.
Yeah, one of the stained glass windows follows the landing on the moon, and it's actually got moon rocks embedded in the glass. But Woodrow Wilson is buried in the National Cathedral, just like all the bodies in Westminster Abbey or something like that in London. But
The most visceral reaction to a gravesite at Mount Vernon. So buried kind of in the yard, right, in a mausoleum that's at the side of the hill, but there's a gate and you can see the sarcophagus of George and Martha. And I said, Van, there is a palpable energy coming from this site, and it was striking.
It is profoundly affecting. Yeah, you're standing there as close as I am
tears,
to you right now saying, wow.
There's something
That's
going
George
on.
George Washington.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And then you also saw George Bush the first and Barbara's grave there in Texas, right?
Yes. Yep.
And just a simple gravesite?
Very simple gravesite, but in a beautiful setting in a little clearing in the woods, a fence around it, and the presidential seal on the pillars there. And it's just George Bush and his wife and their young daughter who died in infancy.
Yeah. Wendy and Van Northcross, thanks for coming in and sharing all your visits with us. This was really interesting. Thanks for being here.
Well, we'll have to come back. We only scratched the surface.
We'll definitely have you back. I'm Indy Todd, along with Steve Junker. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.